Welcome to Perfect Takes. I'm your host, Stephen Patton, joined by my dear friend and co-host, Jacob Acquire. Jacob, it's a little overcast today, a little bit colder, and I think you're a little under the weather. So sorry to hear that. Hopefully we'll still have a great pod, but how are you feeling overall?
Yeah, overcast, under the weather. It's just like the allergies kicking in, that kind of thing. But you always got to be positive, right? You always got to remember Hakuna Matata, you know, from The Lion King. And that really fits because that's actually this week's beer of the week. You found something called Hakuna Matata. It's a tropical IPA. I didn't believe you when you said it was called Hakuna Matata, but here it is. It's not bad. And we always got to look on the positive side of things. And I think that's the way to go starting off in the Panthers segment here. The first wave of free agency is kind of come and gone so far. We talked about a lot of the signings that we had last week. We brought in a total of 12 outside free agents so far. And just looking at, like, our lads, the depth chart, I kind of like where we're at so far, but there are some pretty obvious needs still, even with all the stuff we've done so far.
Yeah, I mean, the issue is you see Brian Burns, YGM, they leave in free agency, and obviously we bring in DJ Wonnum, Clavion Chaisson. We're hoping that DJ steps up in year two. We'll see if that's the case. A lot of the videos I saw in training camp last year had me kind of worried about his development as a professional athlete. And then the wide receiver room. We trade for Deontay Johnson, and that's great. That's one piece, but it was one of the worst groups in the league last year. So you got to add at least one or two more guys there. And then Dan Morgan kind of came out and said that our tight end room was pretty solid. I'm not so sure about that one. That's the one I kind of have hesitation on. It wasn't great last year, even when Hayden Hurst was healthy, and the bank on Tommy Tremble and Ian Thomas going into year two with Bryce Young. I don't know if that's the move. So I don't know if it's adding a guy in free agency, drafting one of the better prospects in this year's class. And then obviously this is the cornerback episode. We need to fill the hole that was left by Dante Jackson in the trade with Deontay Johnson. And so those are kind of the holes right now. Do you think that we'll address edge simply more in free agency, or we'll use a draft pick on that? I feel like wide receiver and tight end would probably come through the draft, if anything.
Yeah, I think it's. I think you got to approach it both ways. Like, I think they're still on the hunt for Clowney. Dan Morgan said as much yesterday at the owners meeting. Where all the GMs and coaches are right now. There's always some kind of press conference every couple weeks with the owners and GMs and head coaches leading up to the draft. And this is this week's or this couple weeks one, I guess. Yeah, I would still go after Clowney, but after that, like, the cupboard's pretty bare. It's like Jerry Hughes or a bunch of really old, like, not washed up, but not in their prime edge rushers, so to speak. There are some still available for trade, like Hassan Reddick, but the word is he wants a deal kind of close to what Brian Burns just got. And if we're not willing to pay Brian Burns, there's no way we're going to be willing to trade for and pay Hassan Reddick. So I do think you need to look at the draft, particularly in the first few picks that we have there at the edge position. And as far as wide receiver goes, I think you're right. Last year, I think we were probably the worst or second worst receiver group in the league. You could say maybe the Patriots were worse. Just because we added a competent receiver to that group, it doesn't mean we're good now. I think we're probably like bottom 10 still, like, as a wide receiver room. So I'm still looking to add a receiver with one of those two top 8 picks, I believe, in the second round that we have. I would like to add one there. And then, yeah, the tight end, banking on Tommy Tremble potential in year, what was this, going into year 4 of Tommy Tremble.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not super sold there. Maybe Dave Canales can scheme him up better than our previous offensive coordinators could. But if Joe Brady, and I like Joe Brady, I like his play designs. If he couldn't really do it, then I don't know. And then, yeah, corner, we're going to talk about a lot of corner candidates later in the episode. I'm excited for a lot of these corner guys in the draft. We did sign Dane Jackson, but I think he's going to be more it's going to be a competitive spot for that spot outs or opposite JC Horn. And then we still have nickel that we need to fill. So a lot of room to work there.
Did we bring back Troy Hill? I thought we brought back Troy
Hill. We did. That's true. You're right. That's true.
And I like that depth. I like that we have Dane Jackson. I like that we have Troy Hill, because J.C. Horn will probably go down with injury like he has in the past. And like, that's, I'm not trying to wish that on anybody. It's just this guy has an injury history. You can't bank on him playing all 17 games at this point. And like you said, this is a deep corner class. We'll get more into that with guys that we like, but you add another body in there. I feel more comfortable about that back end, especially when we brought in Jordan Fuller at the safety position. And we're going to be in a lot more nickel and dime looks, especially with Evero wanting to drop seven guys most plays.
Yeah, for sure. Suffice to say that I would give our early free agency, early offseason grade, maybe like a C, just because obviously we lose Brian Burns, who was one of our better players. But I like a lot of the signings that we've done so far, and hopefully we continue to build on it. I saw a lot of pundits out there giving the Panthers like D's and F's for the free agency grade. I don't agree with that. I think other than the Burns deal, which in and of itself is probably a bad deal, but at the time that they made it, I think they had to get something for it. Just like Dan Morgan said yesterday, it was time to pull the trigger on a Burns trade. So I think all in all, it was pretty positive. I would give us, with that in mind, probably an average to maybe a little above average, like a B minus or something. But I like our free agency so far. And if you don't have anything more to say about it, we got some new rules that were passed down yesterday and today that'll be enforced this upcoming season.
You were the first one to tweet about the rule that got passed yesterday, and there's a lot to be had from an issue standpoint with this, but the hip drop tackle was officially banned, and the NFL claimed that they saw a huge rise in these tackles last year, that they were causing a lot of injury in terms of percentage of pretty much these tackles turning into like severe issues, the biggest one being Mark Andrews getting hurt by the tackle from, was it, it's 55.
It was Logan Wilson on the Bengals. Yeah.
There we go. And so that's the big kind of push of why they did this. And the NFL is preaching that it's safety and whatnot. But all this comes back to is they want to drive kind of the value of the NFL up, and the value goes up when offenses perform better. And this benefits the offense. It's no different than some of the, I would say, cheap shots that can sometimes be at quarterbacks. Those are very definitive rules, though, with like hitting the crown of the helmet, et cetera, et cetera. But this creates a lot of gray area where games could be decided because a tackler's not able to bring a guy down, or he brings him down incorrectly and a ref throws the flag, and there was really no way the defender could have brought him down any other way. And the biggest scheme, and I'm rambling here, but Brett Coleman kind of brought this up, is that if offenses want to kind of abuse this, you run a lot of like tight end routes to the flat, because you're going to have these smaller cornerbacks on bigger bodies, and they're going to struggle to bring these guys down. And so you might have corners that just decide to spear dudes in the knee and causing other injuries from like an ACL concern. And it's just, it's not good. I don't think this was a good move. And what are your thoughts on it? I feel like I kind of got a lot off my chest there, but.
Yeah, my initial thought is I'm all in on Jatavion Sanders at 39 now, the Texas tight end. We need a big body tight end. We needed one in general, but now we need one even more. But I kind of agree. When you get in bed with a new TV deal, so I think it's what, the next 10 or 12 years, with like streaming rights, broadcast rights, all that kind of stuff, and the rise of the gambling partnerships among like DraftKings, FanDuel, all of them, you're going to want to see more points being scored, right? This, like, for an outside audience, more points equals more viewers. It may not be the best thing for the game. We kind of see it how it's working in the NBA, how if you look at like the 2016 Warriors that had 73-9 record.
Yep.
They would be, I saw a chart earlier this year, they would be like the third worst offensive team in the league this year in terms of offensive rating. And that's just how much the league has, I guess, acquiesced to the offensive side of the ball in terms of wanting more points to be scored, wanting the pace to be up, so on and so forth. And you see, it really hurts the game. This is really, this year, Adam Silver, the NBA commissioner, said that he kind of wants to take a look at how they can kind of bolster the defensive side of the ball and help out with some defensive kind of calls, because it's kind of ruining the game the way the offense is being favored. And I don't want to say that a hip drop tackle, which is a normal way to tackle, is going to ruin the game if it's banned, but I do think it's going to introduce a high level of subjectivity into the game from NFL referees, which already is a big no-no. You never want them to be super subjective. You want objectivity because you want everybody to be...
Mylo's Pro Rewards members, go big during Pro Savings Days at Lowe's. Buy more and save more with up to 20% off job site essentials like primed finger joint boards when you spend $3,000 or more. Plus, get up to 25% off PVC DWV pipes when you spend $250 or more. Shop Pro Savings Days at Lowe's. We help, you save. Valid through 123. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Visit Lowe's.com/terms for details. Subject to change.
Be refereed equally and things like that. But when I forget the guy at the owner's meeting who showed off that video of it being a drop tackle versus a swivel drop tackle, when he kind of went over it, you couldn't even tell the difference between one that had swivels and ones that didn't, even though he was trying to explain which ones were. Like, if you just turn off the sound and try to guess, you won't be able to tell. And then I saw people bringing up stuff like the Russell Wilson interception to Buda Baker a couple years ago, where DK Metcalf runs him down the 90-yard rundown, and DK Metcalf is like 220, 30 pounds. Buda Baker's like 180. He grabs him. Metcalf grabs Baker. He puts it, like, pulls him down with his body weight, and Metcalf turns, like, swivels his hips to bring him down. So would that be a hip drop tackle, even though it was the offensive player doing it? There's just so many different ways you could interpret things like this that I don't think it's going to be super good for the game. And obviously preventing injuries is the number one priority for I think it's the competition committee who comes up with stuff like this. But, and I want to say this like in the fairest way possible. This is a sport where we being the fans and the teams that like run the sport, send the players out there wearing armor to hit each other at full speed to try to get people on the ground. Yep. The nature of the sport demands that there are going to be injuries, even though we don't want them because of how physical of a sport this is. And so I'm not sure that something like this is in the best interest of player safety when you still have things like turf, which is proven to be much worse for player safety as opposed to natural grass. But these billionaire owners don't want to pay for that. They would rather just all vote to implement something like this, even though when, God forbid, Lionel Messi's finally in the U.S. now, whenever he comes to town, you got to put grass in or else he won't play. You would think that they would want that investment in their own players, but I don't know.
And I've heard, and we saw the David Tepper fine. It was like close to $300,000. I think in order to maintain grass like that for a year, and I may be wrong, it may not be a year, it may be like a monthly thing, but for billionaire owners, like $100,000 to keep grass on the field, to maintain grass on the field, just seems like a better investment. And it's like one of those things that I think Hunt, the owner of the Chiefs, just came out and he's known to be one of the more frivolous owners. He doesn't spend a lot of money. And the Chiefs organization, in terms of their equipment facilities, some of the other things, have gotten some really bad grades from the NFLPA over the past couple of years. And this is a team that's won back-to-back Super Bowls. And so the owner comes out and says, oh, I'll upgrade the kind of equipment facility. But it's like, you won't take these measures before that. Like, you aren't doing what's in the best interest of your players when it actually counts, when it actually means you're writing the check. Like, it's all these frivolous rule changes that honestly make it more frustrating, not only for the players trying to make plays, but the fans watching. Because like you said, with that DK Metcalf tackle, I watched another analyst kind of rip it apart and be like, well, you didn't read the rule right. That's clearly not a hip tackle. And it's like, okay, maybe we as the public are missing that. But what happens when the ref actually throws the flag on DK on that play? Then you're going to have people up in arms, and it's no different than some of these like pass interference calls that have happened, or some of these other calls that have happened that just make people really upset with like how referees are impacting the game. And I understand from like a statistical standpoint, and if you're looking at this in the grand scheme of things, you're probably going to see one of these calls at most the game. And so it's one call out of when you have like over 100 plays in a game. It's not a huge needle mover, but the more and more of this kind of thing starts happening, I think instead of it just being random noise, I think there might actually be signal with how referees call a game. And this is where the NFL has got to be smart. Like, you can't, like you said, introduce this level of subjectivity. So moving on, there were a couple other rule changes One that we'll kind of touch on briefly before getting into the next big one that got passed today. Teams get a third challenge if the first one is successful. So they don't have to get both right to get the third one now. It's just that first challenge they have in order to unlock that third one. Do you want to kind of touch on the new kickoff rules that were adopted from the XFL?
Yeah, real quick, I like the challenge thing. I think that's pretty cool. If you get the first one right, you shouldn't be punished about the second one. So I like that one. And then today they talked about adding a new rule that if there's like indisputable evidence that the clock has hit zero, that can be replayed from the booth. So that's going to be huge for a lot of the like the fans that want delay of game calls when there aren't any. Because the whole thing is they get a tenth of a second after it hits zero. Well, sometimes that tenth of a second turns into like 2 seconds. Looking at you, Drew Brees and the Saints. So that's going to be cool that that's going to finally be enforced. But yeah, the new kickoff rules. I get that they wanted to try something new and they want more returns. My thing is, if you want more returns, move the kicker back to where he used to be, like at the 25 or the 20. But this new rule, it's definitely interesting. So the kicking teams, I guess gunners, players who field the ball, they all line up, if I understand it correctly, at the opponent's 40. The receiving team, all their players line up at the 35, except the returner. They line up
two returners.
Returners. Yep. So yep. They line up wherever they normally line up inside the 20 or whatever. And then where the ball lands ends up impacting where the drive starts, like if it's a dead ball or a touchback or anything like that. So there's something that's called a landing zone, which is the goal line to the 20-yard line. And essentially the kick has to land there. If it lands in front of it, it's a touchback to the 40-yard line, which is bizarre. That's basically kicking it out of bounds. If the ball lands in the end zone or goes out of the back in the end zone, it's a touchback out to the 35-yard line.
Yep.
So given the offense 10 more yards for the kicker kicking it into the end zone. So essentially he needs to kick it up high, aim it within the end zone and the 20-yard barrier there. So like one-fifth of the field. And if the ball lands there and rolls into the end zone, it's a touchback to the 20, like how it used to be back when we were kids. So that's kind of neat. But there's no fair catches. No fair catch signals. And the goal of this is to have the returners be able to, I guess, get a head start with people not being in their face initially, because the only people that can move before the returner touches that ball or the ball touches the ground are the returner and the kicker. Everybody else has to wait. So it's neat to get more returns, I guess, but I think these touchback penalties, if you want to call them that, are super harsh, in my opinion. I don't think you should be penalized for kicking the ball out of the back of the end zone if you're able to.
Yeah, that was kind of the reason why they moved the kickoff up up to the 35 a few years ago, was to give kickers the ability to just kind of have it be like a dead play, in essence, that you'd kick it out of the back of the end zone, it come out to the 20, then it got moved up to the 25.
Well, it was to prevent injuries was the big thing on that.
Well, yes, but that's the injury risk. And what I will say, I think they've eliminated some of that, because what you saw them do is they got rid of, and I'm going to call them shields, but they aren't shields. But pretty much you would see like blockers for the return team, like lock arms. It was a wedge. That's what it is, not a shield. They would create wedges, and those got pretty much deemed like illegal, because they hurt players coming at full speed at players that weren't going at full speed. And so when you have that kind of level of collision, you would have a lot of injuries. So when you're having these guys that the primary guys that are trying to make the tackle or blocks, they don't start until the ball reaches the returner. Now you have guys going at the same speed. It's almost like a regular snap for NFL play. The biggest issue, I think, goes back to what your point is it's the weird penalties. You kick it out of the back of the end zone, comes out to the 35. We get it. If you kick it out of bounds, it's going to go to the 40. But like most of the time, I would say these returners, when you kick it in between that 0 and 20 yard line, are going to get out to the 20, 25. No problem. But they might start breaking ones to 30, 35, 40, maybe half field mark. Like, it's one of those things where I feel like the reason why they're doing this is to, again, go back to what we touched on with the other rule change in terms of the hip drop, is benefit the offense. you want to have their starting field position be a lot better than it currently is, because to go 80 yards for an offense is something that's really hard to do. So I think they're also trying to cut down on kind of this field control, field possession battle. And that's an element they're affecting it with this. We're going to see what this looks like. It's only a year trial, but there's a lot to unpack here. And the way we explained it, I think, was semi-okay. Could have definitely done a better job. But overall, it's very weird to kind of wrap your head around when changes up to this point have been very, very minor.
Yeah, and I'm sure it's going to be a good thing. We're just resistant to change, or at least I am. At first, like, I didn't like it moving up to the 35 from where you kick it off.
Yep.
Where it used to be at the, I think it was the 20 where they used to kick it off.
Because, I think it was 25.
25?
I think it was, yeah.
Because
it was the 30.
That's when Devin Hester used to be so dangerous, because the ball wouldn't go out of the back of the end zone because they didn't have the leg to get it there. But I'm sure this will reduce injuries, which is ultimately a good thing. So hopefully this sticks and works. Otherwise, if it flops, the NFL is just going to look bad because they got to go back to the normal kickoff. But hopefully it works. Hopefully all the new rules work, prevent injury, increase fair football. But as far as some of them are, like the hip drop tackle ban, I'm not so sure that that's going to be the case. But we should probably move on to free agency, because even though the first wave – I'm trying to be positive. Hakuna Matata, right? Even though the first wave ended, we did get a couple more receiver signings following our podcast last week. The first one being a guy that a lot of Panthers fans wanted at the time, but with some new news coming to light with his contract and the fact that he's not going to be ready for training, like not even during training camp with his injury, I'm not mad that we passed on Mike Williams.
Yeah, no, I mean, his deal, he got 15 mil over one. He joins a Jets squad that is just injury prone as all get out. I mean, they just signed Tyron Smith to be their left tackle, and I don't think he's played a full season over the past half decade.
And to talk about turf and health, that MetLife turf up in New Jersey is the worst in the league. So I don't know. I don't know, Jim, to quote Tony Romo.
And it's exactly what you're talking about there. Not only do they play in a really bad stadium for half their season, they have a lot of these injury-prone guys. So I don't know if Joe Douglas is just trying to have excuses ready when the owner fires them next spring. it's one of those things that get very perplexing when it's like you can add different pieces without having to add guys that have a probability of getting hurt and missing time and affecting kind of your performance on the field, especially when you're trying to make a playoff push in a loaded AFC. So definitely happy that we passed on him. I definitely think we're going to look for a big bodied X receiver that may come in the form of Keon Coleman. If that's at pick 39, I'm okay with that. If it comes at pick 33, I think that there's going to be some issues. He's definitely not a wide receiver I want Carolina to target, but understanding, okay, Dave Canales, he was in Seattle. They had DK Metcalf. He goes to Tampa Bay. They have Mike Evans. And when you look at the supporting cast guy, Tyler Lockett, really crafty, great at separating, smaller receiver, goes to Tampa. Chris Godwin, smaller wide receiver, a little bit shiftier, can get open in space. So I can understand having that kind of duo to create some opening, some looks for Bryce Young. I don't know if that will be the direction, but again, that's why Mike Williams would have been a good fit here in Carolina, regardless of the injury history. Now, the other guy that got signed was a guy that got traded from Denver to Cleveland, Jerry Jeudy. He got it, the numbers got corrected. Me and Jacob were talking about this prior to the recording. Initially, the reports came out, it was like a 58/3. Seems like it's a 52.5/3. I believe it includes pretty much they're activating his fifth year. And then it's like a 2-year extension on top of that. I'm not exactly sure how it works, but in essence, that's kind of the bridge gap they're using with Jerry Jeudy there. They have an interesting wide receiving core in Cleveland. Like it's kind of hard to make excuses for that offense, despite whoever's throwing the ball, whether it be Deshaun Watson or Jameis Winston. You got Amari Cooper. You got Elijah Moore, and now you add Jerry Jeudy. What are your thoughts kind of on that room, Judy's contract, Jeudy as a player? You liked him coming out of Alabama. Just never really played up to par or played up to, I think, what his talent level was in terms of production at Denver.
Yeah, it just never materialized in Denver, I don't think. I can't recall if it's his rookie or second year where he broke his leg and missed most of the year. He's had some nagging injuries after that. Obviously, Russell Wilson, not good during his time at Denver. Just couldn't hit any of his receivers. It wasn't just Jeudy. So just a tumultuous time there, but it's definitely an interesting receiver room, right? Because they have, I would say, probably two of the three best Bama route runner receivers in the past. Like during the Nick Saban tenure, I would throw Ridley in there as well. But they have those two. They drafted out of Tennessee last year, Cedric Tillman. They have Elijah Moore, who was one of your guys out of Ole Miss a couple years ago. It's an interesting room for sure. And I don't know. Just I wouldn't. His extension, I like for him for it to be an unproven guy like this. And even Christian Kirk, I thought, was a bit more productive in Arizona before signing his big deal in Jacksonville. This kind of extension, I'm just not sure where the thought process is. It's definitely going to make it harder for us to extend Deontay Johnson if we want to. So thanks for that, Cleveland. But when they have so much money committed to and pushed down the line with Deshaun Watson because it's all guaranteed and they've restructured it a couple of times during
Did
the
you see
inception.
how Jeudy's contract is structured? It's
I
insane.
have not, no.
It's got $28 million on a void year at the end of it. Like, they have
Which would
pushed the
be,
can.
that would be Watson's final year, yes, of his
I
contract.
believe so.
Yeah,
I gotta let me line up the years. Yeah, go for whatever you're
and
finishing. It's just like it's crazy what the Browns front office are doing.
yeah, Watson's next 3 years are all over 60 mil cap hits just because they pushed it so far and it's all guaranteed. So like you can't get rid of it unless you force him to take a pay cut. So anything you push into the future is gonna show up. There's no like if you cut him, it's all dead money, like all of that. There's no getting rid of his money. So to give a deal like this, especially taking in the fifth year option into the deal, I'm just not so sure because they're already a high spending team, if I recall correctly, like on the all in kind of graph that you made.
They are.
So I just I don't understand it. Maybe they just want more juice, but like why not draft a guy in a loaded receiver class? Like I understand trading for him and maybe even picking up the fifth year option, but this is a receiver class where you could talk me into any one of 15 or 16 guys going in the top 50, and I'd be like, yeah, you're right. That's a really good value pick there. It's just I don't know. And their first pick is, I believe, yeah, I have it down here, pick 55. So maybe they thought one of the 10 best receivers wouldn't be there, or they had another role to fill. But the rest of their roster is still pretty good. Like at pick 55, I think they'd be able to take their choice of whatever they wanted or needed. I don't think there's not a like gaping hole on their roster or anything. So I just don't get it.
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is just having enough able bodies around kind of the quarterback that will be starting. And you are right, Jerry Jeudy's dead cap year, that 28 million hits in 2028. Deshaun Watson's contract expires in 2026. He has one void year in 2027. So all that money is pushed past when Watson's contract expires. So I don't know if Cleveland's idea is kind of moving forward is they would find like a value signing, kind of like a, and this is kind of poking fun at the fact that they drafted him, but like a Baker Mayfield kind of like a project, a guy that's kind of floating around the NFL, drafting a guy in the next couple of years. That may be the move. I think now having draft capital back going into next year is going to be like very pivotal for how they kind of shape that team. But again, it's head scratching in a deep wide receiver class that you would kind of sign a guy like this to that kind of money and not position yourself for the best step forward moving forward, especially when you have so many of these guys locked in the contracts and you can't really afford depth pieces at the moment. So, very, very interesting. But you had a cool game that we were going to kind of run in the middle of the episode. We're going to touch on, and yeah, take it away.
Yeah, so we talked about a lot of the big signings in the first wave of free agency, and to kind of spice up this episode, because outside of the new rule, which was a big piece of content to talk about, it was just going to be corners, right? Because there were no huge free agency signings. But I thought let's kind of review teams, what they've done in free agency in the offseason so far, and what we like, what we dislike about it. So did one of those websites where you write all the teams on a wheel, or all, like a bunch of things on the wheel, and you spin it. Figured we spin it a couple of times and talk about a couple of teams. The first one ended up being San Francisco. So my initial thought is what they did with the D line is interesting. Getting rid of Eric Armstead and then signing like Itur Gross Matos as kind of one of their bigger signings, I guess. They are strapped for cash because it's an expensive team. But what are your thoughts on the Niners offseason so far?
The Niners offseason is an interesting one. They seem to just abandon all other holes on their roster and sign defensive linemen. And I mean, they've made two Super Bowls in the past 5 years, so I guess you can't fault them on that front. But it's very interesting because you have reports from John Lynch, their general manager, going worrying like contract talks with Brandon Ayuk. And then you see Brandon Ayuk's story on Instagram, and it seems like he's not really happy with the numbers they're throwing at him. So I don't know if it's a Brian Burns situation going on there. I know John Lynch said that there were obviously people that I think have tried to call about trading Ayuk. He has not been put on the table. That is not available. But I would think it would be smart to offload Debo. If they're able to trade Debo this year, maybe draft like an Xavier Leggett, Malachi Corley, somebody that's very physical after the catch, and have the time to develop them, because they do have George Kittle, they do have Christian McCaffrey, they do have Brandon Ayuk, to where he doesn't have to be the star day one and kind of morph and develop into the player they want moving forward. They definitely do need to address the offensive line, like we talked about. They bring in YGM. I think they brought in, actually, no, they cut Eric Armstead. Eric Armstead?
Yeah.
And I think the reason why they cut Eric Armstead and brought in YGM is YGM plays really good three tech in terms of the NASCAR package on like a third down. And you want a guy like Nick Bosa getting after the quarterback, especially with the departure of Chase Young, and still having interior presence. So I can understand the move of why they went after YGM. It was just a very rich contract for a guy that really hasn't proven himself at the NFL consistently.
Yeah, I'm with you there. I'm looking up the Niners defensive line coach, Chris Korosek, or I hope that's how you pronounce it. He's one of, if not the best defensive line coaches in the league. So If they believe they can get something out of YGM on a, I believe it was 18 over $2 million deal, then you should go for it, considering you lose a guy of Armstead's caliber, like a fringe all-pro kind of guy. Jacksonville lucked out there after their big miss on Ridley to be able to pick up Armstead. But yeah, the Niners, in my opinion, I do think they have to solve the wide receiver problem. They did bring back Juwan Jennings, I believe, so they have like their depth still. But like you said, he's a dog. He's a guy I wanted to end up a Carolina Panther this offseason. Sadly, that didn't happen, but if Ayuk's unhappy and you have teams out there with receiver needs, like looking at Pittsburgh Steelers, maybe, who have the 20th pick in the draft. Maybe they want to send that and get Ayuk or something like that. That Debo cap hit is looking big, especially when I think Purdy's rookie deal is up after this year, because it's after 3 years, right? For later on,
I think
picks.
It's four.
Or is
Let
it
me
four?
Check on that why you're. I think it's four for everything that's outside of the first round. The first round has that fifth year option.
The fifth
available.
Year. Yeah. So even if he has another year or so, they need to figure that out, because he might be good enough to get them to the play or to the Super Bowl, but he is not good enough to ever be a team that has Mahomes on it. Or if the Ravens had made it, we saw what the Ravens did to them in San Francisco. That was just a shellacking. So I don't know if that's going to be the QB going forward. It shouldn't be, quite frankly. I think he's done an admirable job in his spot, but they have the Avengers. They have the Justice League on offense and on defense. So they're going to have that figured out moving forward. So San Francisco, I don't know, probably like a C or a D, in my opinion, in terms of free agency grade. Didn't really wow or do anything important, and they still have the Ayuk situation looming over them. Would you feel similar in those kind of grades?
They went out, they signed a bunch of dudes in terms of just like these guys that are going to fill holes. They obviously hand out a lot of money to YGM. But I guess I would say until the wide receiver position is resolved, I would have it as like a C-. I think if they were to trade Debo and extend Ayuk, I would move that up to a B. I think that's retaining your stars. I think that's pivoting towards the future and maintaining your keeping the correct nucleus in front of you. Right now, everything's kind of murky. I think they are still trying to gear up and keep the Avengers together for one more year and see if they can make a push with Brock Purdy. He still does have 2 more years on that rookie contract. I don't know if he is the answer. It's one of those things that I think if they jettison one of the wide receivers this year or next year, Purdy might regress. And then people start realizing, like, he's not the guy. And so then it's almost like you're back at square one again if you're Kyle Shanahan, which kind of stinks. Like, we saw Sean McVay, he realized like Jared Goff wasn't the answer. And what did he do? He went out and got Matthew Stafford. And they've been a different team despite having a lot of talent and depth concerns. And they've still been a playoff team. And so it's one of those things that I think we're going to have to see that evolution with Kyle Shanahan and the 49ers in the next couple of years. So you want to spin it again and we'll get on the team too?
Yeah, just ran the spin. And this is an interesting one. We got the Chicago Bears who over the last, we'll call it 13 months for the offseason, I think they have or they've done it better than a lot of people. Obviously number one pick this year, number nine pick as well. They bring in Keenan Allen via trade. I think it was a fourth rounder to the Chargers. They're just setting up presumably Caleb Williams to be in a really good spot. I think I was trying to think about this. This is probably the best spot a number one pick quarterback has maybe ever been in. Andrew Luck, he had an okay situation there, but this is on another level, especially with the defense playing as strong as they did down the stretch at the end of last year. I'm all in on what the Bears have done this offseason. And they get ahead of the uncomfortable situation by sending Fields to the Steelers instead of keeping him until the draft. So they're all in on the rookie QB. I like what they've done.
I like what they've done as well. I don't believe they've extended Montez Sweat yet. And I think that's the big thing I'm holding out for them, because that trade about halfway through last year changed a lot of what they were able to do on the defensive side. And that changed. I like the fact that they were able to kind of retain Jalen Johnson. They went out and they said, hey, I didn't agree with the DeAndre Swift signing. I thought that was a little too rich. But again, they felt like that would be somebody that would pretty much boost that rookie quarterback they were bringing in. They bring in Gerald Everett so they can run kind of more 12, 13 personnel looks in Shane Waldron's system. Like you said, trade for Keenan Allen with pick 9 after drafting their quarterback. They could get Rome Odunze or maybe even trade back a little bit later or get a wide receiver in round 2. And all of a sudden, your wide receiving core is just absolutely loaded with DJ Moore, Keenan Allen, and that rookie wide receiver. And like you said, it's one of those situations where a rookie quarterback going in, that's a really, really good situation to be dropped into and start playing. So I like what they've done. I would give them a B+. Again, it goes back to, I want to see that Montez Sweat extension just so that there's a little bit more breathing room on that defensive side and knowing what you're going to be able to do down in and down out.
So they did extend Sweat mid-season last year. After they traded for him, it was 98/4 is what he got. And he ended up with like 15 sacks or something. So pretty good offseason / I guess trade deadline for them. With that in mind, would you bump them up to an A? I think I'd give them an A for this offseason. Other than the DeAndre Swift thing, that's what's keeping it for being an A+. So super good for Chicago.
Okay. Yeah. I stand corrected. I thought that was a holdup they had. I thought they had the Jalen Johnson and the Monte Sweat issue, but they actually did the smart thing. They traded for the player and immediately extended him. Still going back to this offseason, I'm going to wait on the draft in terms of offseason. I like it as a B+. Keenan Allen's still an older wide receiver. I think that they still need to address the O-line in terms of depth concerns. I may say A-, but I'm right on that bridge of saying that this is probably one of the best off seasons we're seeing, and putting either Caleb Williams, Drake May in the best situation possible come this fall.
Gotcha. All right. So the next team that the wheel has selected is the Minnesota Vikings, who one of their big, probably the biggest offseason move that they made was trading with the Houston Texans. They traded their second this year, their second next year, a bunch of filler picks like seventh rounders or something. And they got the 23rd pick in this year's draft to go along with the 11th pick. They have to be moving up for a quarterback. I don't think anybody's thinking that they're going to pull a Saints, what the Saints did a couple years ago, getting another pick and then not moving up for a QB. So with that in mind, I think they're going for the QB. And they also had some decent signings as well. Obviously, they lose Danielle Hunter to the, I believe it was the Texans, right? But they kind of swapped with them because they got Jonathan Greenard, who was on the Texans last year. They bring in Andrew Van Ginkle from Miami. The big thing, and they also signed Trent Sherfield, the receiver from Buffalo. The big thing is that right now Sam Darnold is the starting QB, but they have to be getting Drake May or Jaden Daniels or maybe even J.J. McCarthy, and I think I would prefer all three of those guys over Sam Darnold. So I like what they've done so far. And the one to top it off, they stole Aaron Jones from the Packers on a lesser contract, which I liked.
Yeah, no, I like what they did on the defensive line. They replaced Danielle Hunter. They brought in guys that were familiar with Brian Flores' system. I think it's smarter to have more of a rotation at that position, especially with Danielle Hunter approaching kind of, I think, that 30-year age mark. And not to say that he doesn't have some good production ahead of him. I think him playing across Will Anderson in Houston is going to do wonders for that organization. I don't know how I would grade this offseason quite yet until I see who that quarterback is. For me, I'm kind of supplanting it as a B. I think their roster before some of these offseason moves were in a good spot. Offensive line homegrown. They have a lot of weapons on the offensive side. So plug and play quarterback, like you can have a lot of go-go juice there. And what is interesting, I think there are obviously a lot of smoke screens that got put up during this draft cycle. The Patriots may really be interested in Drake May. And they may want the Commanders to kind of fumble the bag and take Jaden Daniels. I think if Jaden Daniels is there at three, the Patriots are aware that their organization is not ready for a player of his caliber in terms of having a supporting cast that's good enough to kind of cushion him while he's transitioning from college to the pros. And so I could see them trading with Minnesota, Minnesota going, hey, we have the offensive line. We have the weapons. We're going to make this look like LSU of last year. And him going gangbusters in Kevin O'Connell's system. That is what I see happening if Jaden Daniels is there at three. I think if Drake May's there at three, I don't know if the Patriots move back. And then it becomes a question, okay, do the Vikings try to trade up with the Giants and they think J.J. McCarthy's the guy? Do they wait there at 11 and see if McCarthy falls? That's, I think, where the interesting kind of components come into this. But they're obviously positioning themselves to get that quarterback of the future. I just want to know how that plays out and if they get their guy before moving them up from like a B to an A.
Yeah, we talk about how Caleb Williams is going to walk into the best situation ever team-wise. Offense-wise, it might be the Vikings if you drop a QB in there, because Jefferson, to me, best receiver in the league. I think Addison was the best rookie receiver, him and Puka. And then you still have the great young O-line, TJ Hawkinson. I know you're a huge fan of him. And now Aaron Jones, who is a massive upgrade over Ty Chandler, Alexander Mattison, Cam Akers, whatever they threw together last year at the running back position. So I am all in for them to get their QB of the future. And I think all three of the guys that we talked about would work there. So I'm with you as well. I think B is good. If they can get Drake May, it's going to be an A for me. Funnily enough,
Drake May like that, like it's over at that point in a McVay Shanahan style offense under Kevin O'Connell with those wide receivers. Like I would honestly start putting money on the Vikings winning the NFC North next year. And that's in a division where you have the Packers coming off a divisional round game against the 49ers that they could have won, the Lions making the NFC championship game, and then the Bears reloading like we're talking about. Like if you put Drake May on the Vikings with that supporting cast, I think it's over.
It's funny, we looked at the AFC South last year as one of the worst divisions, and two of their, well, Anthony Richardson didn't play much, but they take two and pick four rookie QBs to compete in that division for a while, and Will Levis at 32. So it's going to be interesting to have a rookie QB at pick one and wherever the Vikings end up picking to have that kind of battle going forward for the next 5 to 10 to 15 years, hopefully. Funnily enough, the wheel chose Carolina next. We talked about them, I think, kind of C+. You take away the Burns trade, I would probably bump it up to a B. I think we're in agreement there. So the next,
I think a C. We need a like. I agree with you. D and F is a little harsh. We need to see what the interior offensive line looks like this fall. Because I'm not going to get my hope up off some free agent signings. They were free agents for a reason. Obviously, Miami wasn't in a position to retain Robert Hunt, but it's one of those things like, why did the Seahawks not keep Damian Lewis? That raises my concern, not that he's not a good player, but it's more just like, could those resources been allocated better? So we'll see if Dan Morgan and Dave Canales know what they're doing, but I want to hold some hesitation for that before bumping that up.
Well, Damian Lewis has the familiarity with Canales and the assistant offensive line coach. So maybe he just wanted to play for some guys he knew. All in all, C-ish is where we're landing there. The next team is the Miami Dolphins, who had a really rough start, in my opinion, to free agency. They were obviously one of those all-in teams like you talked about last year. And so they weren't able to go out and pay big money to a lot of guys. The guys that they brought in were a lot of margin players, guys like Jordan Poyer, who's up there in age, Jordan Brooks, the first-round linebacker pick from Seattle a couple years ago. And they bring in Kendall Fuller to replace Xavien Howard. So interested to see how that one works out.
Yeah, they brought in a lot of big names, but like older dudes. And mm-hmm. So like a lot of people are like making it seem like, oh, the Dolphins just like they reloaded. And it's like these guys are on the back nine of their careers. Like this, like you can't think of them as in the prime. And then you have to look to that defensive side. You don't have Vic Fangio there anymore. So are you going to lose a step with having a new defensive coordinator in the building? I'm not as concerned on the offensive side. I'm going to be curious to see what they do in the draft. Right now, I would say based on where they were, like loaded up against the cap and what they're doing, they haven't extended Tua, which I think is a smart thing, but they haven't addressed the quarterback situation either. So I think this is a team that if in the second round, Michael Penix is there, I think you take a flyer on him. I think that's a guy that maybe you position yourself kind of like what the 49ers have done with Brock Purdy. Granted, he was a seventh round pick, but one of those things where you go, hey, maybe we turn the reins over to a rookie quarterback while we're fixing the roster from a cap situation so that we can rebuild, reload with Mike McDaniel as our coach. So we'll see what they do. Right now, I would probably put them as a C, just kind of getting by, surviving, passing, so to speak. Where are we right now? Team number six, you spun. This is,
I guess, it'd be team five if you don't want to count the Panthers, but yeah.
Okay. We'll do team five.
The Dallas Cowboys, and it's interesting that we landed on them. First of all, they didn't like sign anybody, right? So there's not a ton for us to talk about. Even looking at their RLADS list, they signed one outside free agent, which was Eric Kendricks. And did he end up going? No, I think he ended up on the Cowboys. There's like some thing where he went to a different team.
Why is he on the Cowboys? Who's their defensive coordinator?
Zimmer. That's right. Yeah. I think that's an upgrade, by the way, over Dan Quinn. But yeah, the big thing is today, and it was Ian Rappaport tweeted it out regarding Dak Prescott, that the owner Jerry Jones says, we are where we are, locked and loaded for this year. No indication that a deal is coming. And he said, the Cowboys and Prescott have a mutual understanding of his contract situation with no owners from Dallas, despite him being in a contract year. So with how well Dak played last year, this was a guy that we talked about and you were heavily favoring for quite a while that he could be in the MVP discussion, or the leader of the MVP discussion rather. For you not to have a deal in place with him and to be all in, to partially quote what Skip Bayless said on Twitter like a week ago, to be all in, and not sign any outside free agents other than Kendricks. You bring back a long snapper, so you brought back your guy. But to not have any long-term deals in place with this kind of roster, they better nail the draft, because to me, and if this is an all-in scenario for free agency-wise, it's an F in my opinion. I don't know their spending limits or anything like that, but they have not done anything to tell me that this is a roster that should be in Super Bowl contention next year, as it was thought last year. Going into the season, I thought that they'd won the division and that they had the best roster in the NFC. They haven't done anything to back that up moving forward this year. Every team improves every year. They haven't so far.
So I'm not going to be as negative. And the reason why I'm not going to be as negative is that over the past 4 years, when you look at AV, which is not a perfect metric from PFR, Pro Football Reference, They are the second best team at drafting behind the Kansas City Chiefs. And they brought in guys like CeeDee Lamb over that time, Micah Parsons. Is it Tyler Martin or Taylor Martin?
Tyler Smith, the offensive
Tyler lineman. Smith. So it's Zach Martin is on the right guard. Yeah, so Tyler
who
Smith.
Is,
I'm mixing their
new left tackle, by the way, because they lose Tyron Smith. Is. They lose Tyler Biadasz, their starting center. So they do lose a couple people as well.
I think what they're going to do with this draft is they're going to retool that offensive line. They'll probably take a wide receiver. And so if you take offensive linemen, tackles, great. I think they'll probably end up taking a tackle in the first round. Maybe they go wide receiver in the second and they get an interior offensive line or center in the third. I think they'll reload and they'll be phenomenal on the offensive side. And then bringing in Mike Zimmer, I think he's an upgrade over Dan Quinn. To me, when you look at their cap situation, they have $5 million in cap space this year. Mike McCarthy is on the last year of his contract. Dak is on the last year of his. You want to see if these guys can get you over the hump, because otherwise you need to hit a hard reset. And maybe they position themselves. Trey Lance is on a cheap deal. They like his development and they're able to kind of put him kind of in the driver's seat, draft a quarterback and keep building around those guys, because they still need to extend CeeDee Lamb, Micah Parsons, the guys that we just talked about them hitting on in the draft. And those are kind of what they're pivoting towards the future. I like that. I love that approach. I feel like if they need to address a couple other little holes through the roster, they can do it later in free agency. They can maybe do it with a trade like they did with Brandon Cooks last year. And that's how I see this team kind of taking that next step and staying kind of stride for stride in the NFC. Because to me, when I look at the other teams that they're competing with in terms of the Eagles and the 49ers, as I believe kind of the hierarchy of the NFC, they're stride for stride with those teams. I'm not moved by Saquon Barkley signing. The Eagles may change my mind in the draft. The 49ers, I think they may take a step back depending on, we just talked about them earlier. So it's one of those things that I think the Cowboys are doing a smart thing. It's just not flashy. And that's what's driving media attention, is that they haven't done anything flashy.
I hear what you're saying, but I don't think I could be further in disagreement from what you're saying here. I think all the teams you mentioned, aside from maybe the Niners, they haven't made huge notable improvements, but they have Shanahan. The Cowboys don't have Shanahan, so they can't offset that. You talk about Dallas being in the same class as the Niners and Eagles, maybe roster-wise, but we talk about teams like the Packers, who are much younger and on upward trajectory, who outperformed the Cowboys in the postseason last year.
They did.
We talk about Tampa Bay, who also won a playoff game. I'm not going to put them in the same class, but we also talk. You didn't mention, and this is something we talked about last year when we made our tier lists that we need to do again this year and actually put them on the pod. I had Detroit in that same class as the Eagles and 49ers and Cowboys. Detroit is much better than the Cowboys are right now in terms of the whole team, coaching staff, organization, and everything. So they've passed the Cowboys, in my opinion. If you're going to be all in, and remember, we're doing these grades based on what free agency has been like so far for them, not the entire offseason.
Yeah.
If you're going to be all in and lose your defensive coordinator, he takes a lot of his guys with him. He takes some of the offensive linemen with him. You lose probably the best left tackle in team history, and that's no disrespect to Larry Allen.
I was about to say Larry Allen might have a couple words with you.
It's just, Tyron Smith's the best left tackle I've ever seen. That just might be a generational thing or a generation thing. If you're going to do all that and you're betting on it being a contract year for your team, what happens if you don't get it? You have to hard reset. To me, it's an F, because this should be a team that competes for the Super Bowl, and it looks like they're not trying to. That's just my with these moves, it looks like they're not trying. It looks like they're biting and like waiting in the water where you should pick a direction right now, because this is the pivotal year where, all right, we have to go all in, or maybe not. We should get ahead of the reset. That's what it seems like to me. And with like talking about stuff like, just look at the running back. They lose Tony Pollard. Their starter is Deuce Vaughn now. It's kind of stuff like that. If they're going to be all in, they need to be all in. So hopefully they kill the draft. And if you don't have anything else to say about the Cowboys, maybe we should move to the draft and talk about the corners.
Yeah, we can move on to the corners. My biggest thing is, I'm just going to hammer it home one more time. I think the Dallas Cowboys are phenomenal at drafting. I think they're going to bring in a guy that's going to bolster that left side. I think bolster the interior, and the O-line is going to be solid. Again, these are hypotheticals. I simply like that they didn't bend over backwards to try to keep Tyrone Smith. The guy hasn't played a full season in quite some time. We talked about that when we talked about the Jets. And so it's one of those things that I think they made smart organizational moves. I think, like you said, to say you're all in, I think that's poor verbiage. But I think when you're being smart about, hey, what's going to come up, like, they still haven't paid CeeDee Lamb and Micah Parsons. Like, you gotta keep those in the forefront of your mind that they have superstars on these, on this roster, that are game wreckers, game changers. And so I'm not going to discount that. And to your point, I think the Lions are right there in that class with them. They beat them in Dallas earlier in the year on a controversial call, obviously. Go figure. The refs are playing a role. And so it's one of those things that I think they're still in that upper echelon, regardless of making zero moves. And so that's all I want to kind of say, is that I didn't feel like they made any dumb moves. And because of that, having a good roster and knowing that they're a good team that drafts, that's what I'm banking on. So we'll see if that holds to be true. We'll talk about this more, obviously, when we break down the NFC East and the draft coming up, but I think it's a good time to talk about corners. Two of your top three guys come out of Alabama. Your top corner is Terrion Arnold, who in a interview at the Alabama Pro Day actually was praising his co-partner or a partner in crime, Kool-Aid McKinstry, as being the better corner, better player. But you think Arnold's the number one. He shadowed most of the number ones this year. Why is he your top guy?
We talked about last week how I like safeties that are hitters, right? You know what I like even more than a safety that's a hitter? A corner that hits people and plays the run. And that's exactly what Terrion Arnold is. A lot of Bama corners, and I go back to, like, discipline players. The Saban coaching tree kind of players, like Kirby Smart's players at Georgia, Lane Kiffin's players at Ole Miss, stuff like that. Terrion Arnold is disciplined in his play. He supports in the run. He actually loves to tackle. And if you look at the chart that you made, I got to pull it up with his interceptions, his pass breakups, stuff like that. He actually saw a lot more action than what Kool-Aid McKinstry did this year. And that's not a slight to McKinstry. He blankets receivers and takes them away. But I thought Arnold took a huge step forward with the new defensive coordinator this year, Kevin Steele, moving on from the old defensive coordinator. I thought that his growth this year is something that can't be ignored. I think he's definitely the more physical of the two corners and of the top five that we have here, just really tight cover, instinctual as well. Great ball skills. Like I said, 12 passes defended and 5 interceptions, which is the most among the top five guys that we have here. Just outstanding performances this year. Like you said, took on a lot of wide receiver ones, which traditionally wasn't his role. Like last year, he had to step in for an injury for another guy on our list, Kyrie Jackson, who's at Oregon now. Once he stepped in for him and was able to perform well, just a pro, what you need athletically, what you need skill-wise. There's just not really anything super negative I can say about him, other than he's not like super, super rangy. So he's not going to be like a deep third zone corner or anything like that. But I like what he did. My favorite game from him this year is Texas A&M. I think he makes a ton of plays in that game. And to me, it's hard to keep him out of number one, but the number two guy is really good as well.
Yeah, I want to touch on the first point that you had. It was in my notes, and that he's good at setting the edge in the run game, and probably the highlight tackle that he had, I thought, was against Texas. And it was when Xavier Worthy had pretty much the entire field in front of him, just open space. Like, he was going to house it.
Yeah, fastest player ever, by the way, Xavier Worthy.
Yep, fastest player ever. And Arnold makes a phenomenal open field tackle that pretty much nullifies that. And that's the difference in the NFL, is can you make that play when you're one-on-one on the edge? Can you set it? And I think he checks that box perfectly. I think that was a great point to bring up. We talk about late hands in terms of like wide receivers. I thought he had late hands in terms of a corner. He didn't seem very like grabby, so to speak, but he could see when wide receivers were going to get the ball, his hand was getting in there. It was being disruptive. The biggest thing I saw, and it was apparent when he covered Ladd McConkey earlier in the Georgia game, I believe this past year, it might've been the year before, but it was like an outbreaking route. And sometimes he can get a little, I wouldn't say hesitant, but almost stiff at the top of the stem and can be broken off for these more outside curl kind of routes. So that's what I want to see, kind of his improvement in at the next level. Overall, I think he's 1A, 1B with this guy that we're going to talk about next, who I think personally is the best cornerback in this draft when I watch the film. And it's Quinyon Mitchell out of Toledo. There are so many things I can talk about him, but I want to let kind of the audience hear from you, the guy that watched the film, watched several games of his, what your thoughts on this guy coming out of college.
Yeah, so obviously he didn't face the Ladd McConkeys or the tougher competition that Arnold and McKinstry faced, but that's not a discredit to him. At the Senior Bowl, he was one of the best players there, really showed out during the offseason circuit, and he's just super good. When I talked about Arnold not being incredibly rangy, Mitchell's the opposite. He's really good in zone coverage, can cover large areas of the field, instinctual as well, not as physical in run support, but he's willing to make tackles, really good ball skills. Looking at the chart you've made, 18 passes defended as well. Not as many tackles though as Arnold. Arnold far and away was the big tackler out of all the corners, was 63 this year, whereas Mitchell was tied for second with DeJean at 41, but still a pretty good cover corner as well. Really good vision as well. Something you got to look at with corners is when they are trailing a receiver or something like that, if their eyes are locked onto their receiver and they don't turn and look at the QB, or they don't have the QB and the ball in mind at all times, that could draw penalties and things like that. This isn't something to worry about with Mitchell because he'll always know where the ball is and he'll always keep an eye on the QB. My big critique, I guess, would be that he could be more physical. He doesn't really jam people at the line. Like I said, his tackling is good, but still not as good as some of the other players in the class. But overall, a very, very good and smart and disciplined cover corner.
Yeah, I think smart is the best word for that. I wouldn't say he's the best corner tackler. He broke up several screen plays in terms of tackling from that standpoint. But against, obviously, like a bigger tight end, bigger running back, that's where you start getting kind of maybe concerned if he's able to kind of set that edge. I think overall, he's a dog. I mean, this is a guy that squatted 505 pounds, weighing in less than 200 pounds. Like, that is a testament to just the kind of power and strength this guy has. I'm going to talk about a rep he technically quote unquote lost, but it was Marvin Harrison kind of running like a out route in essence. It was a comeback more against Toledo. And Quinyon Mitchell was on him the whole time. It was a ball that had to be placed where it was for Marvin Harrison to go get it. And for me, when I watch Quinyon Mitchell and I watch him cover guys, he's always right there. And he may not obviously make the pass breakup. He may not always like make the play. But when you have a corner that is always just there on the hip of the wide receiver, it pretty much like diminishes that margin of error for the quarterback. Like, you have to fit it in if you're going to get it to your wide receiver when Quinyon Mitchell is on your guy. So I love that about him. I love his ranginess. I think he's going to be a great corner for me. He's my corner one. For you, he's your corner two. But I think it's fair to say this is 1A, 1B in this class. And then, like I said, at the top of this corner section, the other guy that rounds out the top three, and I think he deserves to be mentioned with these guys because he put up some phenomenal numbers. He passes the name check, which is a huge thing in the NFL, and that's Kool-Aid McKinstry. This guy had an interception against J.J. McCarthy and Michigan in the BCS championship. What is the playoff format called? Is it just
college
the CFP?
Football.
Yeah, it's just the CFB.
Playoff. Yeah.
So the college football playoffs. And this guy, I mean, makes a phenomenal toe-tap interception against J.J. McCarthy, just a very high awareness, very smart player. We talked about that word with Quinyon Mitchell, but I think it applies here with Kool-Aid. What do you like about him? He obviously took on a lot more number two guys playing next to Arnold, but is this a guy that can be a number one at the next level?
For sure. Real quick with Mitchell, you said he lost the rep against Marvin Harrison Jr. It's okay to lose reps against him. All right. That's an unfair.
No, that's what I'm saying. That's kind of an unfair guy you're losing,
ask, but yeah.
If you're losing reps to Marvin Harrison and it's only by a minuscule margin, you're still on his hip. I think that just shows how much his game's going to translate.
Yeah, for sure. That's why him and Arnold are 1A, 1B. But McKinstry's right up there. You said he covered a lot of number twos this year. This is his third year in college. Obviously, he's in the draft now. He was a starter his freshman and sophomore years. Super good player, covered a lot of ones during that time. And to look at his production this past year, it's down a little bit. Arnold had 63 tackles. He only had 32. Arnold had 12 pass breakups or passes defended. McKinstry only had 7. Arnold had 5 picks. McKinstry had 0.
Yep.
And you look at that and you say, oh, wow, McKinstry must have had a bad year. No, he just doesn't get thrown at because he just blankets the receiver. And that's what I like about him. Not perfect, but like very good cover corner. I wrote sticky, which means he's able to stay in the receiver's hips without committing penalties to get in there and disrupt the passes, stuff like that. Really good vision. You talk about fluid hips. That's one of the things you want to see with corners. That's like one of Sauce Gardner's claims to fame is the combine drill with hip fluidity. McKinstry's right there with him. And if you want to look at his drills, he has a Jones fracture in his foot, but still performed at his pro day very well. So obviously a good athlete. And he has good ball skills when given the opportunity. He just doesn't get the opportunity. And my big critique with him is where Arnold is the hitter, McKinstry's not the hitter. He could be more physical as a tackler, and his run support needs a bit of improvement. But overall, if you want a cover corner and somebody that's going to stay in the pocket of the receiver and like just disrupt them, get on their nerves, stuff like that without fouling, McKinstry's the guy in this draft.
I think it's important to note that I think we're holding Mitchell and McKinstry to like Arnold level tackling in terms of the corner class. Both are, I think, are good open field tacklers from what I've seen. You brought up Sauce, and believe it or not, there was a graph by Football Insights, one of the better accounts leading up to the draft than just in general in terms of sports kind of visuals. And he has a chart with yards per coverage snap allowed and forced incompletions. And the guys that McKinstry is next to on that graph are Sauce Gardner and Patrick Surtain. So when when you're talking about a guy that can be sticky in coverage, that's just has a nose for the ball, a guy that's just fundamentally sound, like you love to see that. I think those things translate. My biggest thing is just he didn't play a lot of those number ones. So when he goes to the NFL, if he gets put on against a guy like Justin Jefferson, is he going to lose a rep or two? And I think the answer to that is maybe yes, but I think he's also a good enough player that that's not going to matter in the long run. And obviously when we're talking about NFL players going up against NFL players, you're going to win some, lose some.
Yeah, that's super fair. His freshman and sophomore years, like I said, is where he covered more of the wide receiver ones in the SEC. So he has the experience there. And just like I said with Marvin Harrison Jr., if you lose a rep to Justin Jefferson, it's okay, all right? So I'm not going to hold that against him wherever he ends up. He's taken a bit of a fall in this draft cycle. I think it might be related to like medicals and stuff. Didn't compete at the combine, things like that. But he competed during his pro day with his foot injury. So if he falls to 33, I'm driving to, where's the draft this year? Detroit, Kansas City, wherever it is.
Detroit. Yeah.
I'm going to be there and I'm going to hand the card to the guy to draft McKinstry. but the next guy that we have here, and this is a guy that we alluded to last week due to his versatility on the back end, that's Cooper DeJean from Iowa. You always have to have an Iowa defender in your first round. It's a legal rule. And this year it's DeJean. Incredibly rangy, and you can tell his ranginess and his vision because that's they put him at punt returner. He was their punt returner this year, and he's very good at missing blocks, like evading blockers to get to the tackle and things like that. He's also very physical, like he can reroute and jam receivers at the line, and he is a good tackler. One of my things I said about him is that despite his tackling ability and physicality, when a blocker gets hands on him, especially in screen games and stuff like that, he struggles to fight through it, which is interesting to me because he knows how to tackle. He knows how to evade blockers because he does it as a punt returner. He actually got hurt on a punt return late in the year he didn't get hurt on it. He ran it in for a touchdown. I believe it was in the Big Ten Championship, but it got called back. He did get hurt at the end of the year, though. But it's odd to me that he's able to, or that he struggles fighting through blocks when he is so physical.
Yeah. No, I think that's definitely an element. And with Cooper DeJean, we've moved on to Cooper DeJean, correct?
Yeah, Cooper DeJean, yeah.
DeJean, yes. I just wanted to make sure that we weren't still talking about McKinstry. I think he's got great size and athleticism. You brought up some of his special team ability. I liked what he did as a gunner. I liked what he did as a returner. I liked his versatility on the back end. This is a guy that won Iowa High School Athlete of the Year. He played basketball, baseball, football. He's just so rangy and physical. I think he's a bit stiff, like what I talked about with Arnold at the top of his stem. Can struggle with flipping hips, but because I think he's a smarter player and understands kind of route designs and where the wide receiver is going, he's not always out of position, but I would like to see him kind of loosen up a little bit more. I think that's something that he kind of struggles with, but overall, this is a guy that I think you drop him into a lot of the teams that are picking in the late 20s. He's going to be an impact player day one.
Yeah. And I think, the stiffness problem can be kind of mitigated if he does make the transition to safety, which is what a lot of draft people and NFL people have talked about, because he's so rangy, because he has good vision, can tackle, and can cover the bigger receivers like tight ends and stuff like that, that he might be a safety in the league. I'd be interested to see it. Like a team like Buffalo, who's lost a lot of back-end DBs, could use a guy like this. So it's going to be interesting. I do think he's a first-rouner for what it's worth, and this is the cutoff, in my opinion, for first-rounders versus second-round corners. Even though I hold this guy in high regard, there are some reasons why I don't have him currently as a first-rounder, and that is the Clemson corner, Nate Wiggins. Very, very good ball skills. Trying to find mine right here. Yeah. Very good ball skills. Reminds me a lot of Emmanuel Forbes from, I believe it was Mississippi State last year's draft. Yeah. Who had the most interceptions in college history. Just very sticky on the receiver. Great vision. Like, knows when to anticipate and jump routes in order to get interceptions, stuff like that. Physical. He makes plays in run support, and he's a good, like, he can cover ground like quickly. He's fast. He's a good mover. No wasted movement is what I wrote. And what that means is a lot of times, be it DBs, receivers, ball carriers, they can do this little hop before they move. And it's not like they're trying to cut or anything. It's like they're trying to fake the defender out, and it doesn't do anything. It's just a wasted movement. He doesn't do things like that. He's a no wasted movement, good mover. The weaknesses, obviously, shorter arms, and the big one, smaller frame. At the combine, I believe he measured in sub 170. It was 171, which is still or 173, I wrote it. Still very, very, very skinny. And obviously, he ran a good number. People lose weight for the combine to run. But you can't be that small in the NFL. It just doesn't happen. I mentioned Emmanuel Forbes Jr. Last year, who was one of the best corners in college history in terms of intercepting the ball. And he gets drafted, I believe it was 16, maybe 15, to Washington. And he struggled a lot his rookie year, despite those traits. It's just because he was so small and he could get kind of manhandled by bigger receivers. Like, imagine Wiggins goes to, the Cardinals with their later pick. And he has to match up against DK Metcalf. He's going to lose every rep because of his size. And so I think he has NFL corner traits and ball skills and stuff like that, but he has to add some strength. It's just not going to work if he doesn't. And I actually wrote on my board day one if he gains weight. But until then, to me, and I know he was reported at 180 at his pro day. That's still not enough to me, because you can put on 5 pounds of muscle and your frame is still slight. Like, he needs to get to the 190. It's like what Dante Jackson had to do. Get to about 190, and then your skill will translate. But right now, that's where I have the hard cutoff between round one and round two.
The four guys that we talked about leading up to Nate Wiggins, I felt like they were great tacklers. When you look at the size of those players, great size, great traits. And it's exactly like what you said. When you get the Nate Wiggins, you have great traits, but you're just wondering about like some of the frame issues. Like, hey, are you going to get kind of dunked on? I mean, we saw DJ Moore just completely abuse Emmanuel Forbes on a Thursday night game between the Bears and the Commanders this past year. And it's those kind of things that if he is drafted by a team that doesn't have kind of that cornerback one, or he's thrust into that cornerback one role, I love him. I think he's very fluid. I think he's one of the faster prospects out there from the corner standpoint. He hustles. It shows up on tape. I know that's sometimes been a concern by some people that have talked about Nate Wiggins. I've seen him run down ball carriers that were on the other side of the field. Like, this is a guy that hustles, gets after it, tries to make a play, and he's fun to watch. You just wonder, okay, like you said, can you put on a little bit of weight, maintain that speed, maintain those traits to be a NFL caliber kind of player? And I think that's going to be the big question. So him getting drafted to a team that, say like the Chiefs, they drafted Trent McDuffie, who was a little bit on the smaller side, but great traits, and he's not forced into a number one role. I don't think that really fits the archetype or archetype that the Chiefs like doing. I think some of the corners that we're going to talk about here in a second as kind of being the fringe, the outside, the top five would be a better fit in that standpoint. But going to an established place where he doesn't have to be the number one dude, I think is going to be so key for his development.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more there. I think some of those later first, early second teams that could use their corner too would be really good for Nate Wiggins. Obviously, L'Jarius Sneed is a different type of corner than Wiggins is. He's a bit more physical. But with the Chiefs trading him to Tennessee, that's another free agent sign and trade thing that happened since our last recording. And the Titans extended him. There is a hole at corner there. Hopefully, they take a corner so Adonai Mitchell can fall to 33. But this is a very deep corner class as well, talking about the receivers. Just because I said there are four, and my word means nothing. I'm just a regular guy. I'm sure other people think there might be five or six corners that go in the first round. But despite that, there's like five or six that could go round two and then five or six that could go round three. This is a very deep corner class. And one of the guys I want to talk about is Kamari Lassiter from Georgia. There's a lot of Georgia DBs every year in every draft. And this is a guy that I held in pretty high regard up until his pro day. He ran a very slow number on his 40. And I think going back and watching some of the tape, it kind of backs up what I thought. Like, he's rangy, but he can get late and get caught ball watching sometimes, which puts him a step or two behind the play. And in turn, if you don't have that top end speed like Wiggins does or any of the other guys that we talked about do, you're going to be a step or two behind. So Lassiter, I think, is another great corner, another physical guy that, like we talked about, there's a ton of physical run supporting corners in this class, but he's a guy that I think needs to tighten up his discipline just a tad. Don't stay watching the quarterback or stay watching the receiver, kind of like what I talked about with Mitchell. But I think he can be a good starting corner in the league. And then, I mean, there's like five or ten more guys we could talk about. But I want to talk about the nickel corners as well in this class because there are quite a few that could start day one, in my opinion. You look at a guy like Mike Sanderstil from Michigan. National champion winner with Michigan this year. He does have lapses as well, kind of like Kamari Lassiter does, but he's a good tackler, good in run support, and he'll cover the tight end like you need him to. Exactly what you need in a nickel corner. I think like round three would probably be good for him. I'd like to see him compete with with Troy Hill as well, but he'd be pretty good. And then there are a lot of other guys, but I just want to talk about my sleeper, Daquan Hardy from Penn State. A lot of Penn State corners in this class too. There's three of them that I was able to watch and get good film on, but I think he's a sleeper to be a nickel corner star, whatever you want to call that position in the league. He's physical, good ball skills, stuff like that. So that's a guy I would look at for day three for the Panthers is Daquan Hardy.
Yeah, no, I've mocked Daquan Hardy, I think, two or three times in some of the mock drafts I've put out there. I think he'd be great this slot there, especially I think Troy Hill coming back on a very short extension. You brought up Lassiter. He obviously had some poor testing, not the fastest prospect out there. I like, and we brought up the Chiefs and just kind of having like that cornerback, like true number one. They had Ward, Tre'Davious Ward, that ended up going to San Francisco. They just traded Sneed. For me, if they want to fill a guy that has that kind of just physicality, that size, I like TJ Tampa out of Iowa State. Like, to me, when you turn on his tape, he can lock down people. He locked down Adonai Mitchell out of Texas. I felt like he was just clamps on him. Didn't test at the combine to where he had a ROS, which is a relative athletic score. So hard to kind of compare him to some of the other guys. He is a little bit lighter. He's about 190 pounds, the weight that we would want to see Nate Wiggins at. So he is, I think, a professional weight. But it'll be one of those things that are interesting to kind of see as things play out through the draft, where different guys land. Sandstrill out of Michigan, great slot corner, like you said. Daquan Hardy already kind of touched on. If you want a physical corner, there are guys in this draft for that. If you want a guy that can play the slot, there are guys for that as well. So I think it's a perfect conglomerate of guys after the top five that we talked about, depending on what you want in your kind of defensive scheme. And that's what it's going to be dependent on. When you see guys go a little bit higher, a little bit lower, it's teams sometimes drafting for fit on day two, day three needs. And with that, we're in the perfect takes. We'll kind of keep our takes, I believe, semi-corner related. I'm going to go a little bit different than what you're going to hear Jacob say. I don't think we take a cornerback within the top 100 picks, which is like it allows some ambiguity with what you're going to hear. But I don't think the Panthers take a corner with either of our second round picks, with our third pick at 65. And then I think it's our top of our fourth round pick. It's like 101, 100. So I don't think with our first four picks as they currently stand, we take a corner. You're a little bit different on that. I'll let you take the floor.
Yeah, it seems like you read my take and just wanted to be in opposition of it. I think we will add a corner within the first four rounds of this draft. And you were almost right there at the end. We have picks 33, 39, 65. And luckily for me, we have pick 101 to start day four. So if we take a pick there, we're both right. But I think there is a need at corner. They did reach out to Stephon Gilmore today. So this, like, I wrote my take way before they did that. So maybe they bring in Gilmore and this take is moot. But I do think there's a need at corner two. I'm not sure that Dane Jackson is proven enough to be a corner two in this league, even though his contract is tied to playing time and incentives like that. So he would earn the role. Like I said, if there's a guy like McKinstry, or if Wiggins falls to like 39 or something, I would have like pretty serious consideration about taking them there, because I do think there is a need there, along with taking a wide receiver with one of our first two picks. I'm locked in on that, by the way. Like, even though it's a deep class, I think there is like supreme talent at the top of the wide receiver class. I'm locked in that we need to take one within one of the first few picks, first two picks, yeah. Rather.
If we don't take a wide receiver with one of our second rounds, I'd be okay with us going like 33, taking, like you said, one of the cornerbacks that we talked about falls. We take him at 39. We can take an interior offensive line guy, an edge. And then maybe Malachi Corley's there at 65, which we just posted about this morning. We're going to be doing a series of the top 30 visits. You'll kind of see the thread progress over the next few days. And then beginning in 5 days from now, we're going to do the top 25 players off Jacob's big board. So that'll be exciting. We'll have a lot of content out for you guys leading up to the draft. Next week, we get closer to the line of scrimmage. So we'll be talking about linebackers. And there's one particular linebacker that's played within state that models his game after a Panther legend, Luke Kuechly. There's obviously some concerns, medical concerns with him, and we'll get into that next week. But we'll break that down next week. We'll jump in on any free agency signings, any trades that pop up. If there are any new rule changes that just seem like they're going to alter kind of team building strategies or just strategies in general for coaches. Do you have anything else before we sign off?
I've got nothing. No, I'm excited to talk about the linebackers next week.
Yeah, should be a lot of fun. This isn't, I would say, like a particularly great class. I don't know if it's as empty as like the safety classes, but it's not a loaded class in terms of the wide receivers or cornerbacks that we're talking about, or even throw out like three techs that we'll get to in a few weeks as we wrap up this series. So stay tuned for more content from us, and we'll catch you guys next week.